All right, welcome to session 262, Craft, Creation, and Creed, Frivolity, Utility, and Spirituality. My name's Holly Welker. I am the organizer of this panel. My bio is in the program, and I always feel weird reading my own bio. So I'm just going to read other people's. Actually, I sort of like this bio. Okay. I learned to knit and crochet as a Mary Miss in primary and learned to sew on the cast iron Singer sewing machine that was my mother's high school graduation present from my grandparents. It is now one of my most prized possessions. I began quilting so I'd have some way to use up all the fabric left over from the dresses I like to make. When I was in high school, my mad skills won me the sweepstakes prize at the Graham County Fair for the most blue ribbons in the teen division of the homemaking category. Satin Worship, an essay about my love of textiles, first appeared in Poem Memoir Story, which is a journal of women's literature, and it's more commonly known by its initials, PMS. And it was reprinted in Best American Essays in 2005. Our second speaker, which one of you wants to go second? We'll just go in the order that we're sitting. Our second speaker will be Rachel Mabee Whipple, who is an Echo Mormon housewife, mother, student, reader, and occasional artist. Rachel enjoys creating textile arts by sewing, knitting, crochet, and weaving. Everything she makes, from blankets to costumes, shawls to dishcloths, is made to be used and worn. Rachel has a bachelor's degree in geology and is currently studying philosophy and anthropology at BYU. Our next speaker is Obadiah Schwarzkopf. Although he rides a bicycle, the only spinning class Obadiah has taken was with a group of spinning and knitting grandmothers in San Diego. His winter hat is a merino wool cap he spun and his wife knitted up for him, and he harbors the quiet ambition to grow a field of flax that will one day become a custom-made linen shirt. And our final speaker will be Sarah Burlingame, who has been a Montessori teacher, Eurotrash, zine publisher, artisan bread baker, mother, partner, and blogger at FMH, all with varying degrees of success. She makes her living as the director of religious education at the Unitarian Universalist Church of Cheyenne, but her passion is haunting the Wyoming legislature, whether Cheney is in town or not. She is also a half-ass knitter, seamstress, and craft store barfly, and she also gave birth 9 weeks ago, and that's her really cute baby back there. Well, actually, those are both of her really cute sons there in the back.
I'm so proud of
people. All right. Oh. So, what makes something beautiful? What is the point of beauty, and what should our responses to it be? Those are big enough questions that there's an entire branch of philosophy devoted to exploring them. That's the study of aesthetics. There are many answers to these questions that I like, but among my favorite is this one by Oscar Wilde in the preface to The Picture of Dorian Gray. All art is at once surface and symbol. Those who go beneath the surface do so at their peril. Those who read the symbol do so at their peril. It is the spectator and not life that art really mirrors. Diversity of opinion about a work of art shows that the work is new, complex, and vital. When critics disagree, the artist is in accord with himself. We can forgive a man for making a useful thing as long as he does not admire it. The only excuse for making a useless thing is that one admires it intensely. All art is quite useless. People often object strenuously to that last bit, which I want to repeat. We can forgive a man for making a useful thing as long as he does not admire it. The only excuse for making a useless thing is that one admires it intensely. All art is quite useless. Art has many uses, people frequently argue, talking about how it teaches enduring lessons and refines our sensibilities. Well, maybe so, but those are not utilitarian uses. Once you stick something on the wall to look at, you limit what can be done with it to looking at it and thinking about it. If you take the Mona Lisa off the wall and use it as a serving tray, it's no longer art. It's very expensive, quite lovely, ineffective serving tray. A decade or so ago, I made a baby quilt for my sister who was pregnant. It was in a palette I loved, black and gray and brown, largely because it was made entirely of scraps from dresses I'd made myself, and those are colors I like to wear. I didn't plan anything. I just started cutting and sewing. I was delighted with the results and showed it to my mother, who said, "You're not going to give that to Kathy to use as a baby quilt, are you?" Yeah, I said. "You can't," she answered. "It's too pretty for a baby to spit up on and poop on and get all faded from being washed over and over." "Should I have made an ugly quilt?" I asked, thinking of beautiful baby quilts requiring hours and hours of work that my mother had made. She, after all, is who taught me how to admire and make quilts. She sighed in exasperation. "Just don't do it," she said. "Make Kathy another one." "What'll I do with this one?" I asked. "Give it to me," she said, "for my birthday. I'll hang it on my wall." So that's what I did, and that's what she did. For the last few years of her life, it hung on her bedroom wall right by her side of the bed. It was one of the last things she saw each night and one of the first things she saw each morning. I'm glad my mother talked me into giving her that quilt, and now that she's dead, I get it back. It means a lot to me that it meant so much to her and that she thought it was too beautiful to use. But I also want to use any beautiful quilts I make in the future. I like having beautiful quilts on my bed, though they do fade in the sun or wear from being tucked under mattresses or pulled up to chins. They're intended to be beautiful, but they're not intended to be art. They're intended to be something useful, and all art is quite useless. But here's the thing. I don't feel that way about all the textiles I create, meaning that I don't want to use all of them until they wear out. And I've realized that part of my willingness to use quilts that took me dozens, if not hundreds of hours to make is their sturdiness. Quilts will wear out, but it takes a long time unless you're very careless. Whereas it doesn't take much to seriously mess up a hand-knit lace shawl. As I have learned, which is why I'm not wearing pokey jewelry today. A lace shawl is a frivolous item. It takes hours and hours to make, it doesn't provide all that much warmth, and it's easily damaged. I've made several lace shawls. One was a gift to my sister to make up for the baby quilt she never got, and neither hers nor mine gets a lot of wear. Some might say this is wasted effort, but I don't think so. I enjoy making lace. Well, all except for one lace shawl, which had a nasty, fussy pattern and didn't turn out to be as pretty as I'd hoped, and which is frankly still sitting in my knitting basket, unblocked, 3 years after I cast it off. In all cases, even with the disappointing failure, I learned things about how knitting is constructed and how to create a lace pattern. And while I might not use this beautiful thing very often, I can still use it from time to time and appreciate it. The most utilitarian thing you can knit is a sock, which is also a thoroughly impressive feat. Get it? Of engineering. I was told I would be very proud of myself when I finally managed to turn the heel of a sock, and I was. But I was also proud of all humanity. I kept saying, "Someone invented this. Someone figured this out." If you've never considered this before, stop for a moment and think. Some unacknowledged genius figured out how to make the fabric of a sock have an angle in it, and how to make the heel area fit a foot snugly so that you don't have bunches of extra fabric chafing inside your shoe. And this anonymous genius figured it out on their own, whereas I needed a class to make sure I understood the technique well enough to repeat it. There are knitters addicted to making socks. I'm notorious for wearing things until they are in tatters, then finding some use for them when they're no longer wearable. Old socks, for instance, are good for polishing shoes, and in fact, my sunglasses case is made from two tube socks with the holy bottoms cut off. I have really big sunglasses, and I couldn't find a big enough case, so I just cut socks up and made this case. I'm really cheap. I really, really am. Anyway. Old socks, for instance, are good for polishing shoes, but when it comes to a sock, the yarn for which cost $15, I can't see using what's left of it after it gets a hole in the toe for polishing shoes. So I asked the teacher of my sock knitting class what she did when a hole appeared somewhere in a sock she had knitted, how she darned them, what she did with the sock after darning was no longer an option. "I don't know," she replied. "I've never had a sock get a hole in it. I don't wear any single pair often enough for them to get holes. I've knitted over 70 pair of socks." I've seen quilts and clothing in fine art museums, and doing online research for this project, I discovered some pretty funky socks, but I have never seen socks presented as part of an art exhibit, though someone may have done it. Socks are anything but useless. Socks are utilitarian and get dirty and stinky and must be washed. But 70 pairs of socks is frivolous. But no one in the Western world makes socks or quilts or lace shawls or dish towels or pillowcases because they need to. They make them because they want to. Especially when it comes to knitting, there is not a single thing a human being can make as efficiently and cheaply as a machine. If Oscar Wilde is right that the only excuse for making a useless thing is that one admires it intensely, then what is the excuse for making a very expensive, labor-intensive item that will one day wear out instead of buying an inexpensive and very likely more durable mass-produced equivalent? One excuse is that one simply enjoys the act of creation itself, that it's rewarding to see a project take shape, that it feels good to finish the item. It's also nice to make something that's exactly what you want instead of settling for the closest approximation you can find in a store, though anyone who works with textiles knows well that many projects don't turn out like you intend. There's also the pleasure of design, which is related to and sometimes concurrent with creation, but not always. Back when Project Runway started, a couple of friends who know I like to sew kept urging me to audition for the show. "I'm not a designer," I said. "I can make clothes, but I can't make a pattern. I might have ideas for pretty clothes, but to make them, I'd have to do it by combining patterns that already exist. I wouldn't know on my own where to put the darts or how to frame the sleeve in a garment I designed myself. I wouldn't know how to start only with a concept and make an article of clothing that fits a real human body." What I understand about textiles is substitution, taking the elements someone else has designed and combining them into what I want. If I can't find a dress pattern that's exactly what I have in mind, I can overlay one pattern on top of another and figure out how to cut. If I can't find a sweater pattern that's exactly what I want, I can write out a pattern that successfully combines the elements I do want. It takes more planning with knitting than it does with sewing. I think I've addressed the craft and creation, utility and frivolity aspect of this panel, but what of spirituality and creed? Well, let me segue into that by telling you that this year's theme, Mormon Artifacts and Material Culture, is one I thought up specifically as a way to justify this exact panel. It was a conversation with Rachel and Sarah and Teresa Edmonds, who was on the panel and then dropped off to go do something where they actually gave her money. As Peggy Fletcher Stacks quotes me saying in a piece last week in the Salt Lake Tribune, activities like knitting, quilting, sewing, and other ways of working with textiles are intrinsic to how Mormon women experience their religion. I'm thinking of cross-stitched wall hangings declaring things like families are forever or homemade scripture covers. These are professions of faith. They are ways of creating a testimony instead of merely saying it. Hanging on the wall above my bed is a meticulous, counted cross-stitch depiction of the marvelously idiosyncratic meeting house I attended for the first 17 years of my life until it burned down. It was a huge tabernacle full of character and closets and wide hallways and staircases inside and out that children loved to play on. It was elegant in its simplicity rather than ornate, and it was built with love and sacrifice, a gift from one generation to all future generations, meant to last at least as long as the community that would use it. Its destruction was a devastating loss, and I still mourn it to this day, 30 years after it was replaced. Someone painted that chapel during President Kimball's tenure leading the church because it was also the chapel he attended as a child, and for that same reason the painting was printed in the ensign. Someone made a cross-stitch pattern from that painting, and my big sister Susan, who knew how much I loved that building, stitched it for me as a Christmas gift. I remember watching her work on it. I would roll my eyes and think about how much I hated doing embroidery. The stitches so small, the results purely frivolous and ornamental. But when I opened a package containing it on Christmas morning, I began to cry. It was both object and message, a memento of my lost church, of my sister's love for me, a visual reminder of just how much work people are willing to do to create something beautiful for people they love. And that is an idea that trends both aesthetic beauty and usefulness. Adorning walls and bodies and beds with things that are both object and message, transient expressions of enduring ideals. It's a way of anchoring what's most expressive and fulfilling in what's most quotidian and mundane, what we look at and use every day in our homes. It's one of the clearest statements of values. Here's what I invest extra work in. Here is optional effort I make because I want to. All right, so Rachel.
All right. Why am I nervous? I've always liked textiles. I'm fascinated by the textures and patterns woven into and printed on fabric, the drape and feel of cloth. I enjoy sewing, cutting and piecing together two-dimensional planes into three-dimensional shapes, clothes to wrap around my body, linens to dress my home, covers for my furniture, and bags to carry it all in. Patterns are useful, but it's so much fun to work without them, to free sew my way to a solution of a puzzle that I've put before myself. I guess I'm a little bit different from Holly in that. I was like, hey, let's see what we can make of this. And that's how I make a lot of costumes. We get some weird stuff in our house. I relish the sensual experience of going to a fabric store, seeing and touching all of those many bolts of fabric. And then I learned to make fabric myself. I learned how to weave. And I love weaving. I learned to weave about 8 years ago. My husband and I were talking about what kind of place that we'd like to have to settle down in. And I said I wanted a lot of land so that we could have animals like sheep. Sheep? Why would you want sheep? Now, aside from a family connection, my father grew up on a sheep ranch, and it was his mother who taught me to crochet. The reason I wanted sheep was for the fiber. Good wool yarn is expensive. And any project seems cooler and more authentic the farther back you go, the more from scratch you make it. At the time, I only knew how to crochet. But one of my character traits, which may well be a flaw, is a boundless confidence in my ability to do things that I have never done before. And that's why I'm here today. Now, Clint loved the idea of raising sheep, and even more than that, like learning to spin and making things. So he checked out a book from the university library about Navajo weaving, and I read that book 4 times. The first time I read it, I understood very little until I got to the end. And the second time I read it, I'd built up enough context from my first time reading that I was able to understand it. The third time I read it was as I was building a Navajo frame loom using the diagram instructions from the book. And the fourth time was as I was weaving on it. And I made my shed sticks and with some cotton rug warp and some fat wool yarn, I wove Navajo style textiles. And it was amazing. It worked. I created fabric out of just a shapeless line. I'd made a flexible plane. And there was strength and beauty and order. And I'd made something that I'd only read about previously. And after I went through that entire experience, I learned that there were weaving classes at UCSD. And man, that was so easy after what I'd gone through. Those little table looms, much more efficient, much easier to learn on. And that's where I learned about weaving textures and patterns in the fabric. So rose path, twill, this one is huck lace, crackle. And I learned how to dye bouts of yarn, to paint a warp, to draw the geometric cartoons that represented the texture that I would be weaving into the fabric, and how to tie up and treadle my own structures in the cloth. And so I bought books, I bought yarn, I bought looms, I was given yarn, I was given looms, and I wove. But as years passed, including a couple of cross-country moves, in which we moved my big floor loom, which is like this, yes, across the country twice, I found I was weaving less and less because I have small children. And weaving is fairly forgiving of children's interruptions, more so than knitting, because honestly, I hate nothing more than to have a kid pull my stitches off my needle. Bad, bad thing. And with the loom, it's there. It's all tied up. It's safe. But the children are more vocal in demanding my attention than the weaving is. And that's as it should be right now. So now weaving is a treat. It's a rare escape for me. I like to warp a loom during general conference. Now, warping is a very slow, tedious process, and it's perfect to do while you're listening to the radio. You know, I stay awake and semi-attentive during the talks, although I have no idea who is saying what most of the time, which sometimes is good. And I get real work done. It generally takes the entire weekend to measure out the warp, tie it into bouts, and dress the loom. Now, each thread has to be tied onto the front beam. You go through the reed. Each one goes through its own heddle, and you tie it on the back beam and wind the whole thing up. So this can be, you know, just maybe a couple hundred yarns for, you know, something thick like a chenille scarf, or it can be, you know, over 1,000 like this shawl that I'm wearing now. After the warp's tied on, I have to check the pattern to be sure that I got all the threads in the right place and that nothing is crossed. So I weave a little bit to check, and then I unweave, I untie it, I make the corrections, I tie it back on, weave again, just to make sure that it's right. And this is the point where you have to have the most patience, because you've done all this work. You just want to weave the thing, because weaving is fast and fun. It's very rhythmic and soothing. But if I don't take that extra time to make corrections now, the error will run through the entire length of the fabric, and it will bother me with each shot that I throw and every time I see the piece after it's finished. And this is the only time that you can really make that correction. So then I get to weave. Perched on my bench, counting through the treadling, I imagine it's kind of like playing an organ, but instead of sound that vibrates through the air and fades away, I can see the fabric grow solid under my hands. I like this because I've not decorated something. It's not that I've added a personal touch to an otherwise finished product. Most crafts fall into this category. That are the category of being entirely useless junk made of disposable elements. I have very little respect for most things that you can find in Hobby Lobby and Michaels. But that's why I tend to despise crafts. But I really appreciate true craftsmanship and artistry. When I finish weaving a piece, I have created something. I've created, you know, whole cloth, and it did not exist before I began to work. And the further back I take the process, so dyeing, that's, I have someone to do spinning for me. I don't spin well. But combing, carding the fiber, maybe someday even we would have animals that we would shear and raise ourselves. The more control I exert, the more that I have brought order out of chaos, and I've made something that's practical and beautiful out of the raw stuff of nature. Can there be anything more magical? And at the same time, more mundane. The shuttle passes back and forth. The harnesses rise and fall as my shed opens and closes. I beat the reed, gathering each newly laid line of weft into the fabric, packing it in until that line of weft, that thread, is no longer its own individual thing, but simply part of a greater whole. So it's in and out, over and over, the rhythm of beating, shuttling, treadling. Like everything in life, there's a rhythm to it. It's like the tides rising and falling, the morning breezes rushing out of the canyons, the sun and moon rising and falling through the skies. It's like my breath, my heartbeat. It's like my work at home, washing clothes, hanging them on the line, gathering them back in, watering the plants, weeding, harvesting, composting. Harvesting the compost for next year's garden. With weaving, I feel all of these cycles in this quiet, repetitive work, and it's all there captured in the fabric that I've made. The weaving gives perspective to the real work of housewifery that I do every day. Now, weaving is old, but this largely feminine craft is not glorified like more masculine art of, say, war. You know, Penelope's weaving was exceptional for the fact that she made no progress, not for how good the fabric was that she created. I think part of this lack of glory is that weaving is necessary, and it was tedious and repetitive. In Mormon history, my rather cursory research of weaving turned up very little. There is mentions of wearing homespun, which necessarily meant hand-woven. Brigham Young's push for silkworm production and the establishment of different woolen mills. We had one in Provo, not far from where our home is now. In Palmyra, New York, next to the church-run museums, there's a little coverlet museum, not affiliated with the church. And in it are hundreds of wonderful hand-woven summer-winter coverlets, and they are gorgeous, fascinating pieces of art. And it was my favorite part of our trip to that historic area, and I'm sad to say that although the official church sites were packed, the coverlet museum was empty. The weavers are not the actors we most value in the stories we tell about ourselves. But in every culture, weavers have found ways to make the necessary beautiful, to move the functional beyond utility into art. For me, this is the great revelation of weaving. Not only that what I must do, I ought to do well, but that even that damned, dull, repetitive pedestrian work of living can be an act of beauty. I can almost imagine the cloth of my life, the shots of yarn that are my dishes neatly stacked as I dry my hands from the soapy warm water, the lines of weft that are me opening the windows each evening to let in the cool night air and closing them in midday and pulling the draperies to block the hot sun, waking and sleeping, running and walking, kneading bread, making summer tea in the sun, going to church, reading with my children, and that wonderful feeling of finally laying down exhausted at night. This is the life I've made. And when I stand to be judged, it won't be a book that is read. It will be the bolt of fabric that I have woven that will testify of my life.
Okay, just a few introductory or opening. My name is not Obadiah, I'm Clint. But I like Obadiah and I'm fine leaving that. The other is I brought some spinning implements or whatnot. I was a missionary for 2 years and I never really warmed up to proselytizing on the gospel. It was always something I, you know, felt an obligation to do. But I proselytize at will the spiritual aspects of spinning. So I'm that's why I brought it. And if anybody wants to see or learn about it, I'm happy to talk more about that. And I appreciate the remarks before, Holly's remarks about the frivolity of crafts. And I think that's a good introduction to what I want to talk about, sort of the frivolity slash, or the frivolity of considering craft as a spiritual endeavor. I have always been drawn by artisanal endeavors. Practical objects cultivated by hand in a process requiring careful attention and skill, what Robert Persick called quality. A wooden table or chair crafted with hand tools, a little glue, and expert joinery. A glass blower performing an intricate ballet as she turns a glob of silicon into a shining orb. I was a graduate student in biology at San Diego when I became fascinated with textile arts, and Rachel has told that story a little bit. I had tried my hand briefly at pottery, at the UCSD Craft Center, but after spending several days trying and failing to center my clay on the wheel, I became resigned to the obvious fact that making a beautiful set of handmade dishes for my family was not in my future. So somehow we landed on textiles. It had everything that appealed to my sense of quality and authenticity. I could engage in the entire process myself, with access to minimal resources, from producing and processing the animal or plant fiber to finally weaving or knitting a functional article of clothing. It was practical, providing for a basic necessity of life. It could engage our whole family in different stages of the process. It required skill and attention, and the final objects produced would possess a simple beauty, hopefully. As I researched various aspects of fiber and textile production, I was drawn immediately to spinning. Most of those who take up the spindle describe a similar experience when they first feel its pull. I was enthralled by the transformation of a puff of loose fiber into a soft and sturdy yarn. It is like the magical transformation of straw into gold. A simple application of twist to a bundle of fibers creates one of the most basic artifices of human culture. I wanted to perform this alchemy, so I found a class taught at the senior center, where a group of mostly grandmothers and retired women would gather every Wednesday morning for 2 to 3 hours and spin together. This community was a delightful change of pace from endless hours in the lab, running gels, reading journal articles, etc. We would work on projects at home, and then we would gather and share what we had done. We would admire each other's work and practice new techniques. And as I acquired the skills, spinning became a meditative practice. And I looked forward to the weekly sessions where I learned my new craft and shared with my community. My newfound delight in spinning became complicated, however, as I learned more about its history. My instructor in San Diego pointed out one day that the sails of the ships that Columbus brought to the New World were woven from hand-spun linen. Having spent several weeks spinning a single, modest skein of yarn, the enormity of such an undertaking was hard to fathom. The fact is that many women spent untold hours laboring for slave wages to produce the linen yarn in those sails. This was a drudgery that few of us can now imagine. And there I was spinning, or there I was in my spinning group, weaving And there I was with my spinning group, wearing mass-produced cotton poly tees, in a comfortable air-conditioning room, and we were spinning yarn for fun. Was this just an absurd form of nostalgia? This question continues to bother me. On the one hand, a deep yearning to engage in the simple, handmade life preached by the American prophets of Thoreau, Wendell Berry, calls to me. On the other hand, it seems a farce, bordering on the insulting that we bourgeois turn to these traditional forms of livelihood as a diversion from the empty lives that our prosperity has secured for us. What would the 15th century teenage girl laboring into the night with stiff fingers to spin the sails for Columbus have given for such a luxury? There is clearly a movement afoot these days, inspired by the likes of Michael Pollan, Barbara Kingsolver, to grow our own food, raise backyard chickens, build our own writing studios. And critics have rightly pointed out the irony inherent in this movement. Can frivolous pastimes, however earnestly we engage in them, ever satisfy our own deep need to be centered? I don't know how to resolve this dilemma, but my need to understand the phenomenon that I experienced when I'm drawn to spinning has greatly been aided by the writings of Albert Borgmann, who is a philosopher of technology at the University of Montana. Borgmann sees our modern discontent as arising from the paradigm of a technological age, which he calls the device paradigm. And in order to understand the device paradigm, it is first necessary to see what it has replaced, namely a focal thing or a focal practice. A focal thing is something that sustains, orders, and centers our lives and activities. Borgmann points out that the etymology of the word focus, in contrast to our current usage, where focus has been reappropriated by the physics of optics and now means to make something clear or to direct your attention, the Latin word focus means hearth. We can recognize this connection in the related Spanish word fuego, or fire. The hearth was at one time the center of the home, giving meaning and order to the daily activities of the family members. It required daily care and attention to keep the warmth handy. Fuel had to be obtained, wood chopped, the fire tended so as not to go out or to get too cold or too hot. The hearth was the place of warmth and gathering for food and socializing, thus engaging members of the household physically and socially at the same time. As a focal practice, the hearth ordered the lives of the house in the sense that it prioritized their activities. Without tending to the hearth first, little else can be done in the home. It is not surprising, then, that for the ancient Romans and Greeks, the hearth was a sacred space, the habitation of the household gods. We maintain a relic of that centering function of the hearth in some of our buildings. But it has become merely symbolic. I noticed that there's a gas fireplace downstairs in the student union here, right? However, it no longer performs such a role, but is merely an ironic or nostalgic flourish. The true center of this building here is more likely the food court, or maybe even the computer kiosks. Hard to say. So things have changed, right? Many things can, like the hearth, be focal things, and practices, so long as they engage us in our world, require cultivation and skill, and provide order and meaning to our lives. Borgman contrasts focal things with the device paradigm. Technology removes focal things and practices from our lives. In the place of the care and centering solicited by the hearth, which we experience as a focal thing, we now have central heating, which we experience as a device. A careful analysis of central heating will further illuminate the character of a focal thing or practice. Central heating nominally fulfills the same human needs as the hearth did at one time. Both heat the home. But even a cursory examination of how that is done will show that the central heating does its job precisely by leaving out the centering, ordering, and sustaining aspects of the hearth. Technology has removed the source of the heat from the home center. At the same time, we are no longer engaged with a critical component of our home. No need to gather fuel. No need to tend a fire. No need to take any thought, whatever, about home heating. Indeed, the best devices are those which are invisible to their users. Now heat comes, seemingly by magic, from a vent in the floor, which we hardly notice. It is true that there is likely a furnace somewhere in the basement, but few, if any, of us would know how that furnace is working, how to construct or to repair one. It works invisibly and in the background. Families do not gather around the heating vent or furnace to socialize. It provides heat to us as a commodity, and that is how we engage with it. When we engage with it at all, it is as something that we pay for at the end of the month. As a commodity, central heating has unencumbered our lives. We no longer must devote hours of our day to furnishing our homes with warmth. Devices improve our efficiency. They free up hours for other leisure activities. Free time that sadly we tend to fill with solitary consumption, TV, internet browsing, other diversions that alienate us from our physical world and the others that we share this world with. This is what Borgman calls the device paradigm. Devices take what was once a focal practice, remove it from the central place in our lives, unencumbering us from the drudgery in the process. The unexpected irony is that we are left with an emptiness once filled by the centering power of the focal practice. I turn to spinning, I think, as a focal practice. It requires skill and attention. It engages me physically. It opens up a new world of fibers and a community of spinners, fiber producers, knitters, and weavers, in which I have become embedded. Spinning made manifest what was hidden from us by the device of the woolen mill. I visited the Pendleton Woolen Mills in Washougal, Washington with Rachel shortly after our enchantment with the fiber arts, and I was floored. Truck-sized bales of wool that would have taken me a lifetime to spin were washed, carded, drawed, and spun by enormous machines over the course of hours. The resulting yarn was woven by computerized machines so fast you could not see the passage of the weft through the warp. The clothes that we wear are of remarkable quality, consistent, finely spun yarn, precisely woven. These clothes appear by the magic of the device paradigm in our stores, and we are thus unencumbered of the untold hours of drudgery that would be required to spin and weave a shirt by hand. We can readily buy inexpensive clothes because they have been rendered commodities by the device paradigm and thus stripped of their focal potential. As a reaction to the focal losses inherent in purchasing nearly all my clothing, I have indeed harbored a quiet desire to engage in the entire production of a single article of clothing. I have obtained some flaxseed. It's sitting in my office. And I want to plant a single plant. Harvest its seed, all of it. Replant that to get a field of flax. And then I will process that flax. Red it. There's this whole long process you have to go through. I'll learn. And weave it, and then have my wife Rachel weave a simple cloth that can be sewn into a shirt. From a single seed to a shirt. And I'm unashamedly drawn by this project. I am at the same time uneasy that what I am searching for cannot be really satisfied. A hand-spun, hand-woven linen shirt has an aura of authenticity only in comparison to the cheap and readily available clothing provided by the device paradigm. Technology thus heightens our experience of a focal practice. This shirt would be a singular object spun and woven with the idiosyncrasies of my local soil, my spindle and spinning technique, and Rachel's loom. But at the same time, its very singularity ensures that it will always be relegated to the sidelines. I do not have the time or the means to produce all my clothing. Indeed, it would be a small miracle if I can complete this project at all and get tenure at the same time. This sobering realization brings back the central irony of focal practices undertaken as craft or hobby. Can they ever have the power to truly order and center and sustain our lives like the Roman hearth, and not just divert us during our leisure time that has been freed by the very device paradigm that sends us craving for something more authentic? Can our handiwork be anything more than a diversion? Are we doomed to live incommensurate lives, a working life ordered by the device paradigm that facilitates the free time to pursue a leisure life devoted to authentic focal practices, which must remain a diversion? Or can we somehow recover the central organizing power of a focal practice without rejecting all technology and becoming a Luddite? I have no easy answer to these questions, but if Borgman's analysis is correct, and I find his arguments compelling, then these are the questions that concern anyone engaged in crafts, gardening, woodwork, art, or any other potential focal practice as a way to mitigate the emptiness of our modern lives.
I just want to disagree with one thing that Clint said. Some of us have tried spinning and did not feel that pull. We felt something entirely different.
Well, this is my presentation is a lot shorter, and I'm going to excuse myself by saying that I found out a week ago that I was going to be on the panel, so that's my excuse. I thought I would mix two of my favorite things about my connection with Mormondom: family history and craft. Okay. So my grandmother, Betty Sue Price, was born in 1925 in a town that wasn't big enough to even be a town. It's called Calamine in central Arkansas. And my grandma couldn't wait one more second to get out of that town. In May of 1945, the Allies accepted the unconditional surrender of the Nazi Germany. And 1 month later, about 3 weeks later, actually, my grandfather, Willis Arlen Bass, would return to Arkansas from the South Pacific, where he'd served aboard the USS Petroff Bay, and he asked Betty Sue to marry him, with the promise of leaving for California on the very same day. And she said, hell yes. And on the eve of her wedding, her father and brother-in-law-to-be approached my 19-year-old grandma, who had waited for her childhood sweetheart with the sure knowledge that he was her ticket out of Arkansas. And my grandma told me this story when I was 19, and I was full of disillusions about the olden days and how idyllic life had been back then. And grandma told me that when Moses and Manly Price approached her, they assured her that what they had to say was no reflection of their love for her, and that, indeed, they wished that she could have been a member of their family. But, Betty Sue, you ought not to marry Willis. Why ever not, my grandmother rejoined, even though she knew. She knew my grandfather dressed well. She knew his style set him apart from the other boys in rural Arkansas. And she had also seen the pictures of Willis aboard the USS Petroff with his shipmates, how close they had stood together, how one man's arm seemed to always find its way around Willis's slender waist in a more than friendly embrace. She also knew that Moses Bass had no words for what his son was. And indeed, in 1945 Arkansas, my grandfather's homosexuality was literally unspeakable. So my great-grandfather merely said, Willis ain't right. And repeated, you ought not to marry him, Betty Sue. But among the dozens of pictures that Willis had taped into a scrapbook of the war, was one photo of Betty Sue Price standing on the red dirt in front of her parents' house, dressed for church in a white pillbox hat, matching purse, and slender white gloves hiding her hands that were rough from the cotton picking that she loathed, despite her desperate ministrations and nighttime applications of cream. And beside this photo, Willis had written, "Betty Sue Price, the only woman I'll ever love." So she married him. And will it surprise you to learn that theirs was not a happy marriage? In 1963, Betty Sue found herself a divorced single mother of three children. And this is where my story, my connection to craft and homemaking begins. While my grandmother is remarkably liberal for her generation, outspokenly pro-choice, and devoutly opposed to racism, was one of the reasons she wanted to get out of Arkansas. She's a woman who draws sharp distinctions. Yes, her family in Arkansas was Nazarene and indulged in the occasional strychnine drinking and snake handling. But when she was able to choose her own religion, she became a Baptist, and not, she would tell us, those foot-washing Southern Baptists, either. The more decorous American Baptists who kept their seat when they said amen and refrained from rolling around on the floor when the Spirit took them. And while they were undoubtedly poor growing up, they were not trash. Her mother, Junie Lee Price, was a hard woman, but she made and mended her children's clothes, canned peaches in the summertime and made pies in the winter. She taught my grandmother to use the coldest spring water when making pie crust, who in turn taught her daughter, who taught me. I place tap water that I get from my tap in my kitchen in the refrigerator for a half hour. But I know where that lesson comes from and how deep the roots of that recipe run. So Betty Sue was taught with a mixture of maternal love and the harshness that's born of generations of poverty. She knew her responsibilities to her husband, home, and children, and she understood that even in the heart of the counterculture, her community in East Bay, California, still expected her home to reflect the hallmarks of 1950s homemaking, home-cooked meals, tidily turned out children. My mother tells stories about how her mother would brush her hair and tell her, you know, beauty is pain. And she would tell me that, and I would see these pictures of my mom who looked like, you know, young Adams family or something with, you know, her hair pulled back so tightly that, you know, her skin was stretched and the pins that were placed in it. But she was tidily turned out and well-scrubbed floors. How the hell was she meant to accomplish this while she worked full-time at Montgomery Ward? Paid significantly less than her male counterparts since the wisdom of her day, and let's be honest, our current day, dictated that higher wages were the providence of men, the head of the nuclear family. There was no child support forthcoming, and there was little time to connect with other women who, even if she could find them, were not likely to lend her emotional support, since a single woman was a threat to their own marriage. And as radical as my grandmother's departure from her rural Arkansas home was, she reinforced the message to her only daughter, my mother, that a woman's worth was measured by her success in the home. It was a self-fulfilling and a self-loathing prophecy. So my mother, like her mother before her, could not wait to leave her home. The summer she graduated from high school, that auspicious year, 1969, she moved up north to attend college, joined the Baha'i faith, and within a year had met my father, a fellow Baha'i and student on the GI Bill, having served in the Special Forces Army. And my father was the oldest of five children, and I imagine among the many things my mother found attractive about him, he was an attractive man. He is an attractive man. Was how happily married his parents were. My mother yearned to have the home she had fantasized growing up in, stable and loving. And how does one show love and stability? Well-heeled children, fresh-made bread, and floors that were always, always scrubbed. So my mother made it her mission to be that homemaker. But my father's job took him away 4 days out of the week. He was a soil scientist who would work out in the field and then return home on Fridays, expecting, when he returned, a well-ordered home. So in a way that she'd never anticipated, my mother's life had begun to mirror her own mother's life, expected to perform the role of dutiful domestic wife with very little support in her day-to-day existence. The true commonality between my mother and my grandmother, I believe, was their unhappiness, their dissatisfaction with their lives. Their other commonality was their inability to find a framework to express that dissatisfaction or distance themselves from their expectation for themselves to perform as ideal housewives. So how this played out was a sort of mania on my mother's part to bring me to heel. My brother was very obedient, and I was not. But while I listen to friends whose mothers were similarly out of control and abusive, they tell of late nights, rotating boyfriends and stepfathers, and booze-soaked admonitions. My mother was a Baha'i. Our home didn't house Listerine once my mother saw alcohol listed on the back. My parents never, to my knowledge, fought, and all of our meals were made from scratch. I once came home from a friend's house excited to tell my mother that there was a box that you could buy and it would produce a real cake in far less time than it took us to measure out ingredients. And my mother sniffed and said, "Just because you can doesn't mean you should." So all of the trappings of proper domesticity were there, but when I failed to obey, and my defiance became an external manifestation of how incapable of controlling her home my mother was, she would take a belt or a wooden spoon to me. My childhood narrative is woven between images of myself as a child kneeling in the corner of my closet, hoping to escape my mother's wrath, and that of my mother leaning over her sewing machine, racing to finish a dress or hand sewing me a doll, or picking fruit and canning it in our cramped trailer in the summertime heat of Winnemucca, Nevada. My mother wanted so badly to create a home that was a refutation of the brokenness she grew up with, but I believe because she couldn't confront those expectations and the patriarchy that girded them, she was, of course, doomed to repeat them. Overwhelmingly, the lesson that I learned about homemaking was, do it. If you're bad at it, if your children hate the clothes that you make them and wish that you would purchase them something made from children in China from Walmart, if you grip your knitting needles and pull your stitches too tight because you are ignoring your home that is crumbling around you, do it. The domesticity that I inherited is fraught with bitterness and confounded expectations, but it's home. It's how my mother told me that she loved me. And I want to explain here that my sensibilities are not delicate. More than one time in my life, I've been told that I'm a stone-cold bitch, and I've smiled. I don't mind that at all. And I just say that because if you don't already know me, I want to frame the story correctly. When I turned 33, we were visiting my parents. Not just us, but about 30 of my relatives had descended on my parents' tiny little northern Idaho home for a family reunion. And my mother revealed on the eve of my birthday that she had no time to bake and she hadn't wanted to overheat the kitchen, so she had ordered a sheet cake from Albertsons for me. And pragmatism and thick skin aside, I burst into tears, and I choked out, "A store-bought cake means nobody loves you." It's true. Because as flawed as my grandmother, my mother, and myself are, cooking, sewing, canning, and crafts are how we show our children that they're loved. So while I struggle to accept the lessons they've taught me, our legacy of chaos and bitterness inextricably woven with deep love and biscuits. Biscuits that my mother made just because I asked her to, because they were my favorite. I haven't really made sense of these lessons yet, and I hope to get there someday, and I hope my sons will learn from my mistakes and break the cycle of repeating them. And like the women before me, I sew clothes for my children, one crooked stitch at a time.
So happy. You know, this is part of why I love Sunstone, and this is exactly why I love putting together panels. I pick this topic that I'm really interested in, and then I ask smart people, and they come and they say really interesting things that help me better understand and think about this issue. I will say that I have spun I like it, but I'm not good at it. I don't have time to practice. It's hard. It's just really, it's
impossible.
It's like a 2-week intense frustration, and then it's just
fun. Oh well, all right, but still, like, I mean, because yeah, like it's really easy to like turn the spindle and stuff, but like to not break the yarn or to splice it. You know, there are challenges. And the thing is, it's just sheer skill in ways that knitting isn't. Like, you have to learn to do something. Anyway, all of this. The thing is, and I'm especially thrilled that Clint is here, because when I first envisioned this, I thought of it entirely as gendered and female. And of course, the word spinster is used to refer to an old maid, an old virgin, a counterfeit woman, because it was something that real women didn't have that much time to do. That you moved beyond it, especially now that spinning is done by machines. Only a counterfeit woman, one who is not, who doesn't have a family, who hasn't been sexually initiated and so forth, would do that. And so to have somebody who can blow up some of those stereotypes and can talk about spinning as a fulfilling practice and so forth is really, really cool. Anyway, let's have a conversation. So I don't just want questions. I want to hear your reflections. I don't want a Q&A as much as I want a conversation.
I want to see Clint card some woolen.
So this is we could spend too much time doing this.
Yeah.
This is just a shorn sheep. These are locks from a sheep, and you can just take a lock and just.
You need to have your tetanus shots current if you're carding.
Yeah, you can actually get sick, I guess. I don't know. He's kind of spread the fibers out. Look at that. And you have a nice little fluff of fibers here. And then you can card out a whole bunch at the same time and make a little roving that you spin from. Or you can just take this and card out one lock at a time, and then you can just spin that directly. Yeah.
Now,
do
you have a spinning wheel? Also?
Yeah, I have a spinning wheel. Okay. Yeah.
But this is another.
And this is just, it's really as simple as just putting some, I don't want to do this.
It's just that simple.
This is not the spindle I use most of the time. My other one has a hook on it, and I have to give this a little bit of a preparation here so you can get it going. There we go. And it's just as simple as putting some spin and twist into a bundle of fibers, and they no longer stretch out, and there you go. It's as easy as that.
But again, isn't it somebody invented that, and they invented it actually over 10,000 years ago? And I want to recommend a book. Did either of you get this or read it?
It's on my list.
It's called Women's.
Yeah.
Women's Work, The First 10,000 Years by Elizabeth. I don't remember if it's, I think it's W-A-Y, not W-E-Y. Elizabeth Wayland Barber. And, you know, she talks about the fact that one of the oldest human-created artifacts they've found is string, that in those caves in France, they found twine that people would use. They would use a ball of twine to guide their way in and out of the caves. And so we've been making fiber for 10,000 years.
It may be a lot longer than that, because if you go away from arrows, you know, stones, the earliest thing we have that isn't stone is the impression of a net.
Okay.
It dates back 30,000 years.
Wow.
Sarah Bluffer Hardy, who's an anthropologist in Davis, and she wrote this great book, Mother Nature on Women, Infants, and Natural Selection. And she says that, in looking why some societies thrived, when others didn't, because fiber breaks down and just isn't in the record, the pre-written record, and isn't doesn't survive as well as spears and things, that we had overlooked the invention of weaving, or however you got a piece of fabric to make a sling, so that a woman could go farther afield to obtain protein, still nurse her child. And this, anthropologists have this kind of, algorithm of, miles afield that you can go and still get enough protein to sustain yourself, and how it directly relates to your tribe surviving or not.
Right, right.
But that, we didn't have the physical record of it, and a largely male field never considered.
Yeah, and that's actually one of the things I like about this book, is she actually talks about some of her research methods, and it's just ways I had not thought about asking questions.
Yeah.
So
besides the sling, the reason you had a net was because women and children could catch large animals using a net. If you put it down over a game trail and then make all the noise up at the top of the valley, you could get them caught in something they couldn't get out of.
So
that was how, they often talk about the guys with the big bows and arrows, but a lot of the protein wasn't that way.
Yeah.
It was in nets that were made by spinning.
You think about, this alpha male sort of concept, but if children don't survive,
right, it doesn't matter.
It really doesn't matter. It's a little bit of an end game there.
Yeah. And oh crap! I don't remember what I was going to say. Tamara, go ahead.
Well, it's all right if I change a little bit from fiber to cooking.
Uh huh.
My mother was and is a horrible cook. And she almost finally got to the place where she got, so she celebrated it. But I remember coming home from school and she'd be in tears because the cookies burned again, And I mean, years later she figured out you gotta have a dark sheet and, stuff like that. It was just awful, and we're all awful cooks. But I do remember she said one time, I can make good bread, and you're going to learn, she said, you're going to learn to make good bread too. And the reason that you're going to learn to make good bread is you're Mormon. And this is how you are, it was this direct connection between me and the Mormon foremothers.
Yeah.
And, it's kind of funny because I don't know that Mormon women on the plains were any better at cooking bread than, I saw on Little House on the Prairie on TV that they cooked bread, there too. But she sort of equated Mormonness with bread making, and she believed that in spite of all the crap that went on in her kitchen that she produced herself, and never believed she'd really make good cooks out of any of her daughters, she believe that this is going to be the one exception. We're all going to learn how to make, and she can make great bread, and I can make great bread, and it's about the only thing I can do. Mm. And we don't even do it anymore. We just buy like everybody else. Yeah. Same thing that everybody's saying, this thing about being disconnected. But there was this event when she said, you're going to do it, and it's because it's Mormon. And so you have this connection through the generations, through this sort of odd producing of food, or in the home.
A necessity that that is that is now actually frivolous.
Yeah, it's totally frivolous.
And for some families, it's gardening. I mean, it may not always be food, but it's it's some sort of traditional, authentic, old worldly craft.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
And I but for me, I like I said in my talk, I just find it interesting that that I don't know. Can it be? Can it be the kind of thing we want it to be? I don't know.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk about metaphysics and cosmology. Runs
the awesome.
Family, okay?
Cool. Yes, yes, yes.
Because as a little kid, I was fascinated with the periodic table, and I became a material scientist. The word material, of course, as you know, traces back to mother. It's to matrix. Hmm. It's the womb. Hmm. And so for me, when I learn about these things, what fascinates me is also the physics. You take a one-dimensional object, by magic, you make it into a two-dimensional object. Hmm. And then, as you've said, those who know how, by putting the darts into it, make it something to cover a three-dimensional object. Mm-hmm. That's extremely interesting in the point of view of, we don't like to think about magic, but that's magic.
Well, I actually remember reading a book on, one of the few books that I actually remember reading as an undergrad that just blew my mind. It was called Giordano Bruno and the Hermetic Tradition by Francis Yates. Had to read it in this crazy honors class on German Romanticism. The other stuff was crap, but that book was amazing. And it actually talked about science plus religion is magic. Mm-hmm. And which was an interesting definition that, and when you decouple them, you get a different way of understanding the process. So I'm perfectly happy to call it magic. I think that's really cool. And one of the things, this book, it had this really interesting, you know, everybody wonders, oh, you know, the Venus de Milo, what was she doing with her arms? Where are her arms? Well, in this book, she has this terrific illustration. She's spinning. Her Venus was the goddess of both love and textiles, and where her hands are in the right place for holding a drop spindle, just as Clint was doing. And of course, the Greeks believed that textiles were an appropriate metaphor for a human life. You know, the fates had, and I actually love that, the idea of death as a really hot chick with very sharp scissors. So
Speaking of magic, I mean, I had a bakery and I just did primarily sourdough breads, and I mean, if anything is magic,
it's
like
yeast.
Sourdough and wild yeast is. And I mean, think about how long it's been in existence, and we really still don't fully understand it. It was about 15 years ago that Ed Woods, who's a spindle sourdough expert, learned that the process, because what they thought until about 15 years ago is, you know, you have some flour and water, you have something that begins it, like maybe some, you know, raisins or something, that attracts wild yeast, you know, from the air, but we don't know why it attracts this wild yeast. And it was about 15 years ago they discovered that it was a symbiotic relationship, that it is both receiving and giving, and that and another thing is that the word for, you know, the starter, the barn, in almost every culture is mother, because it has this magical, procreative, unstoppable fertile element to it. And I taught a bread class in Laramie, Wyoming one time, and I mentioned that and kind of waxed melodic about the mother, and you can call it the mother and things. And I forgot about it. There were about 15, 20 people in the class. And I used to sell bread at a farmer's market in Laramie. And so like a year or two after I taught the class, I was standing at my little stand on the corner, hawking bread. And this woman approached me with a huge smile on her face. I didn't think I'd ever seen her before. And she looked maniacal because she said, "Sarah, I killed my mother." I know. You said we couldn't kill our mother, but I did. And I just would say, like, okay, well, good for you. Thank you for stopping by. I know. And she was like, "Do you remember? I took your class." I was like, "Oh, thank Jesus."
You killed your sourdough starter.
I'm sorry, I encouraged you to call it your mother. Those tense, like, 2 minutes of, like, I'm like, what else will you do? And when she explained to me, I did say, like, you could have revived her. I shouldn't have thrown her out. You should have believed me when I said, you can't kill her.
I come from a long line of craftspeople. And my English ancestors, some of them made lace, some of them were framework knitters, master framework knitters. I've been over to England where they still, have the framework knitting machines on display. So I could talk about crafts and crocheting and all that kind of stuff. But I want to talk about food. Because 2.5 years ago, my daughter was diagnosed with celiac disease. And that means that gluten in wheat and rye and related grains are poison to her. And so I cook better than I used to cook. And it's important now for us to have organic food that is grown in more natural ways. And because that's really something she needs, because the toxins are more absorbable through her leaky gut than to the rest of us. And food has always been for me something that was kind of an interruption in my life. It was something that I had to stop doing what I wanted to do, to go and make food and eat it and clean up after it. And now food has become the focus of our lives. And it has been an amazing transformation in the way I think about food, because now food is no longer an interruption. Food is that wonderful thing that nourishes us, that we do together. And we always ate, our family always ate at least ate dinner together. But it's just that amazing thing about our life that is just has become the focus of our life. And so now I'm thinking about
Albert Borgman says exactly that in the book that I'm reading of his, is that, what can... a lot of these things are gone, and we just can't get them back. But some of the few things we can get back, he thinks, are the culture of the table, and that is, we all have to eat, right? And we don't have to eat meaty dinners, right? We can, make our and it's interesting that you see that same thing.
Well, and that's actually a big hole in this program. Mary Ellen worked very hard to try to get somebody to talk about food, and
if I'd known that, of course, I told her I was too busy to do anything, but I would save time to do that.
Yeah,
I
mean, really, I made this, some of you already heard this, but this is really important to me, okay, so I'm going to plug it again. Page 4, 2012 symposium theme. In 2012, we invite proposals focused on Mormons and Mormonism as a political force. Think beyond senators, governors, and candidates for president. Ask yourself, how do Mormons deliberately try to shape the social fabric that covers us all? And yes, I wrote that, and I threw in that fabric reference. How do they cooperate among themselves and with others to get what they want? What is the political and social fallout when Mormons organize, canvass, and vote in order to make an entire state or country choose the right? How do Mormons exemplify the feminist adage that the personal is political? In short, how do Mormons exercise, submit to, challenge, and understand power? And can you really be both Republican and a good Mormon? It's personal, it's political, it's Mormon, it's Sunstone 2012. I would like to think that we could find a way to make this panel work with that theme. And you could certainly deal with food, the politics of food.
Food is amazingly political.
Yeah, and the way Mormons do and don't want to address that. I mean, these are, you know, Some people were like, oh, that's going to be so boring, just election stuff. No, it's everything. And this is part of what we really need to get to, is what are the political ramifications of our choices? You know, what are the political ramifications? I love the story about Columbus and the sales. And just, my stomach literally dropped when you said that, to think of weaving the sails for those boats. The clothes we do wear, and of course, you know, I mean, yeah, I knit this myself, but I have no idea where the wool actually came from. It is. It's sock yarn. It's 85% wool with just a little bit of. Yeah, it is.
Yeah, cool. I guess it was cotton too.
She's got fuzz in it though.
Yeah.
Cool.
It's sock yarn. Yeah. Anyway. Were you raising your hand, Mariella?
No.
Okay.
I have not knit socks yet. I need to learn.
The woman who taught me to knit socks said that socks are the true labor of love, because everything else will, like, you know, if you knit a sweater for someone, they'll wear forever, but socks will actually, like, wear out. So you have to really love somebody to make them sock.
No, I'm a 4-H leader, and one of the things I teach is quilting. And I had an 11-year-old boy among my students this year, and he ended up winning the first prize out of all the junior quilters that quilted. And I hope it's not because he was a boy and everybody else was girls. You know, I don't know what the political ramifications of that is, but he, using very, you know, traditionally feminine craft, he created something strikingly masculine with black and red and gold and big blocks of color. And it was, you know, very striking, and he enjoyed it. He's going to be on his bed. And my own son, who is 9, made doll quilts for his sisters for Christmas. And he loved when he could do long strips and that rhythmic idea that you were talking about. Or I guess that was you, Rachel. And, you know, I want these boys to be able to claim that craft for themselves if that's something that brings them joy.
Someone that works in my lab, a man, wants to be a quilter. And I was like, really? Wow. And he educated me that the best quilters, the most respected sort of artistic quilters in the country are mostly men. I don't know if you knew
most respected chefs. Everything.
Yeah, yeah. I was just surprised that was considered a manly enough thing that men would be. Chefs I knew all along, right?
But I was surprised. It's the difference between the words seamstress and tailor, cook and chef. It's very strong.
Right, but
gender.
But in quilting? Right. I was surprised.
And actually, the really hip quilting magazine is published by a gay man.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I can't remember. I can't. You know.
Oh, I can't remember either. But it's called Quilter's Home.
Yeah.
The name of the magazine.
And actually, I mean, I would take a little bit of issue with that, because there might be a couple of,
I don't know anything about,
you know, but there are amazing quilting artists. Like, I mean, people whose work really truly is, you would never put it on a bed. They sell for 5 or 6 figures. Their work is, and they're typically female.
Yeah.
So I mean, there might be men moving into quilting at this point, but knitting was originally a male art, and there were knitters' guilds that women could not join. Right. However, all children learned to knit, and they had to knit their own woolen underwear.
In Switzerland, knitting is still a part of the public school curriculum. Like, by the time you're 12, you need to know how to
knit. It's great for kids with attention deficit issues.
Yeah.
Likes to knit?
I have a 24-year-old soldier son who knits.
Yeah. Well, all children had to knit their own underwear. And it was one of those things, if you didn't knit it, you didn't have it to wear, and you were very, very cold in the winter. But yeah, it was very much a male activity.
Framework knitters were male.
Okay. All right. And opposed to hand knitters?
Yeah. But like Silas Mariner, that's a male weaver.
Most of the weaving guilds were dominated by men, though, I think.
Yeah. But I was talking to Rotali, that's the difference between taking this practice that is tedious and necessary for everyday life, which is when women do it,
right.
And then a man comes in and becomes an expert at it, and it's no longer the daily thing, it's a craft.
Right.
Which is why it's interesting that, you know, material mother,
father. That's such an obvious connection, and I can't believe I didn't make it. Thank you so much for pointing that out. Yeah, especially since Mother in Heaven is so immaterial and
not to me.
Yeah. Well, I am glad, but in the theology, right? Yeah.
In fact, let me do one thing more on that.
Okay.
You've heard of string theory?
Yeah.
So that's the idea that you try to get just uncreated matter, and you put it, and instead of being a bag, it turns into a string.
Okay.
But the universe we live in, according to the string theorists, is a 10-dimensional universe. So we have these strings that are somehow wrapped in a way we can't figure out, because the possibilities of how you wrap the string number in numbers that are even beyond the spots in the universe. It's 10^1,000th power. So you think of it as God's cat's cradle.
Okay.
You've taken string and woven the whole universe.
Huh.
And, of course, I think that's a woman's job.
Okay.
To weave the universe.
Okay.
That's just me.
Very Carolyn Pearson.
Yes, well, yes, and physics, too.
Huh. Well, we have, what, 6 minutes? But I don't care if we don't. I mean, if we're done talking, we don't have to. I mean, this isn't a class. I'm not going to make you.
You're not dismissed.
Thank you.
Thanks.